You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Hi, hello, and welcome to Call It What You Want. I'm Jimmy Conrad alongside Jesse Marsh and Charlie Davies, and we are officially back from Dallas. Jesse, where are you? Are you back in Italy?
Italia. Yep.
Italia. Great to see you.
Made it
long
back.
Trip back. Yeah. But you look fresh and rested. Charlie, maybe not looking as fresh and rested, but maybe I'm wrong. It was good to see you on Morning Footy today, but you're back in the studio.
Back in the studio, Stamford, Connecticut. Let's go. I'm back in the saddle.
Okay, good. I love your energy right now. Okay, we got some big topics, obviously, to talk about. We put a little button on the U.S.-Mexico final that we won. Dos a cero, just to remind everybody. Then, our U-23s came back from 2 goals down to tie France 2-2. We'll get into that. The MLS referee lockout is done. It is finished. We'll talk a little bit of that. And we got Felipe Cardenas coming on to talk about El Tri and Mexico and their issues overall. And that should be a lot of fun to get his insight. But first, it's tradition. We're doing the word of the day. Are you guys ready for this? Let's go.
Let's go.
Baby, here we go. Okay. Now, we're going to start with spelling again. And it's S-O-K-K-E-R. And it's pronounced soccer. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you the clues first. I feel like this is better. Give you the clues first. Clue number one. A legendary former player from the nation where this language is spoken was the only African on the Porto team that won the 2003-2004 UEFA Champions
League. South Africa, Benny McCarthy.
Chuck was ready for this. Jesse's out. Chuck is back, everybody. Chuck is
I didn't even get a chance.
Let's go.
Charlie's wow. Building some momentum.
Ah, he's eating up.
Africans.
Africans.
And you got Benny McCarthy right, too.
Hold on, Charlie. Respect. Yeah,
thank
Charlie.
You.
Respect.
Thank you.
I couldn't even finish the clue, and he nailed it. Unbelievable scenes. No, way to go, Chuck.
And the player.
I'm really proud of you.
Respect.
Okay, boys. So we've had a couple days to sit with our feelings about the U.S.'s big 2-0 win over Mexico. I kind of want to get into what were our biggest takeaways from this? It could be positive. It could be negative. It could be right in the middle of that. Pros and cons, whatever you want to go. But let's start with a big takeaway for you, Jesse. When you came back, you got to sit with it, reflect, as it were, from the emotional high of winning a trophy. What was one of your biggest takeaways for the U.S.?
Just depth of options, right? A squad full of young, talented players, you know, fun to watch the group play with confidence and belief in themselves, have a bunch of guys that no matter, you know, if it was Miles Robinson or then comes in Tim Ream or whether it was Musa and then comes in Tyler, and just it you start to feel like the future we can continue to build and continue to get better. So yeah, that's for sure. The overall talent of the squad is I think a big plus right now.
All right, Chuck, before I hear yours, my big takeaway was that I actually don't want Gio Reyna to play for his club team anymore. I want him to be fresh for us. That guy is super ready to go when he's got a ton of energy and he's got a little chip on his shoulder to prove everybody wrong. I need Gio Reyna not playing regularly for his club team. That's my big fun takeaway. What was your big takeaway, Chuck?
I guess the importance of Tyler Adams. I think we all knew how good Tyler Adams is and I think how he can cover so much ground and defensively what an asset he is for this group. But I think more importantly, his all around game distribution now shooting from distance, which Jesse, you didn't even know he was capable of doing. So I just think in terms of what he brings to the side, both on and off the ball, in transition, almost like an on-field coach as well, is something that you look at and you have to admire. So I think the importance of Tyler Adams being back in the squad, given he hasn't really played all that much, is pretty impressive. Same with Tim Ream. The importance of Tim Ream, his experience, his calming presence in the back. He has this aura about himself. He reads the game so well that whoever's partnered with him really benefits from playing alongside of him, because he is so good with the cover and putting fires out before they happen. So I think those are the two players that I watched outside of Gio Reyna's magical performance across the two matches that I say, wow. There's not really a price tag that you can put on how they play. It's just almost like it's one of those players that you look at and you go, wow. I mean, if they're fit and healthy, they got to be on the pitch.
I want to add also Sergiño Dest, right? Like, he, for me, the difference between, if he would have been in the match against Jamaica, I even think it would have been a different type of day, because he just has the ability to beat a guy, to break things down, you know, especially against a deep block. And what was really great to see in the Mexico game is when he can defend these 1v1 situations and he can continue to develop his defensive responsibilities, then I think you have a real complete player. So yeah, I think all three of those guys coming in against Mexico were a big, big bonus.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I'm glad you brought up Sergiño Dest, a compare and contrast from just the mere presence of those three players when they played against Mexico. Just a different type of balance within the team. And I think we were lacking that a little bit against Jamaica. Okay, one of the other things I want to bring up, and this gets a little bit into the weeds for you soccer nerds out there like us three. I thought it was interesting in the buildup, when we had the ball, our buildup phase, that we had basically Chris Richards and Tim Ream spreading out a little bit to be our two. And then it was our line of three with midfielders. So you had Gio that was kind of dropping into that almost Anthony Robinson spot. Then you had Tyler sitting centrally, and then Weston would drift a little bit to the right. So you had two, and then that line of three. And then we had five. We had our outside backs up high as wingers. We had Haji Wright hoping to touch the ball. I think he touched it like five times the whole game. And then Christian and Timo were trying to find those pockets of space. And that was an interesting – I mean, it worked out. And I think Mexico didn't really know what to do. I don't know if it was my favorite setup, I should say, and how we want to move. Because to your point, I think you guys talked about it at halftime and postgame, we want Gio a little bit higher up the field, a little bit more connected. But ultimately, it worked out. We got a good result. And I thought the game plan, whether you agreed with it or not, was well executed. I just want to know from your guys' perspective, because this is kind of a pro and a con for me. I love that we have outside backs that can bomb forward and want to get there. But sometimes I feel like they occupy space and almost get in the way of Christian Pulisic, who we also want to isolate in 1v1 situations, and Timo Weah. And I don't know if we've completely unlocked the best way to move in those particular moments. But Chuck, I'm coming to you first. Do you see in the same things? And what do you think a nice solution would be there?
Yeah, I mean, in this game, I think in the first half, it was a lot of trying to figure out what Mexico is going to try and do in terms of tactically. Are they going to try and do anything different? Press, play long balls into the channels. When I think Gio Reyna, he eased into the game a little bit more so in the second half, but Jesse and I were talking about it at the desk, just being a little bit more straightforward with your play. Stay true to the touchline, being a traditional up and down winger, maybe come inside in the final third, but have everything be a little bit more easy. Less is more in this case, because you have some players who can beat the Mexican backline one-on-one rather easy, because I think that's the weakest part of this Mexican side is not only their backline and their lack of pace, but the midfield. We're typically used to seeing a Mexican midfield that controls the tempo with the players of the likes of Guardado, who gets on the ball and almost absorbs all the time. And then you're forced to defend because of his distribution. Edson Alvarez is a player who's breaking up plays, but he's not getting on the ball and dictating the tempo and spraying the ball around. So that's where Mexico is really lacking in terms of the presence in midfield, having someone who can flow in and out of possession and can command attention. So I think with the U.S. having Gio Reyna be a little bit more on the ball in the attacking third and centrally, so he can go left and right and push, we were missing that. But ultimately, everyone else stepped up. So I think that goes to show what Jesse was talking about, the lack of talent and depth for this Mexican side is something we haven't seen before in the past.
Yeah, listen, when I talk tactics, it's always a sensitive thing because it's like I'm attacking Greg Berhalter, okay? But
which you are.
This is what I try to do is I've said plenty of positive things that Greg's done and decisions that he made, like starting Tyler and, you know, a lot of different things that we were discussing along the way. But in the end, like it's good to have a tactical model. And then for me, it's good to understand how to maximize the potential of what your players can bring to the game. And so sometimes I feel like we overemphasize the tactical model and underemphasize how to put players in positions to be at their best. That's in the end, if you're just asking me what it looks like on a day like Mexico. And for me, of course, it works out because we're better than Mexico. Like that's the obvious truth. But you know, I'm just, when I'm watching the game, I'm trying to think about how to really use each player effectively to get the most out of him. So, you know, like some ideas would be maybe Anthony Robinson more a part of the buildup phase like Gio was, and Gio up the pitch in a lot of the positions that Anthony Robinson was. And then, you know, you can always then, as you start to play into the midfield, you can always push Anthony Robinson up and rotate him into the attack a little bit more to work off of Christian's shoulder or cut or make these inside runs with Christian. And then you can shift the team. And maybe that requires Weston McKennie to stay at home a little bit more and be in the middle a little bit more with Tyler Adams. And they can control that defensively and with counter pressing, you know, but just that's what we were talking about. This is just trying to put each player on the pitch where they're comfortable, where they're most effective, where they're dangerous, and how to put the pieces together. So that's the way that I see it and saw it, and it works out. But then you're just I'm also looking at, okay, what will it look like against the best teams and in a long-term vision leading to Copa America and what the World Cup will be?
Yeah, I have been doing the same off camera, just thinking through, okay, we tried a tactic that maybe we haven't tried before and it worked. We got a result and Gio had a good game. He dropped a little bit deeper and joined the attack a little bit later. Okay, now when we play these friendlies upcoming against Colombia and Brazil, they're going to notice that we tried a little bit something different. And, oh, hey, by the way, why don't we just sit a player on Gio Reyna and see if they can beat us somewhere else and just try to slow down their main connector of passes or whatever it may be. And do we have an answer?
I would welcome that because that forces them to have to find different solutions. And this is where I give Greg a lot of credit over the past two games is the adjustments, because the substitutions in the first game, the right substitutions in the second game, forcing Christian and Timothy Weah to be a little bit more direct and stay higher up the pitch and not coming deep or coming inside. And that's where they found a lot of the joy in the second half. So his adjustments were spot on if I'm analyzing both games.
All right. So what's our big takeaway then? I guess not necessarily from like a player perspective or in game, but just from the tournament overall. For me, and I think the question that we should probably enter into here is, have we outgrown this rivalry with Mexico? Because we are slapping these guys around.
Oh, don't say that, Jimmy. Come on. This is our three.
I know. And, you know, it feels a bit cyclical. Like at some point, they're going to figure it out and maybe we're going to be a little bit down and they're going to – no, maybe not. I don't know. It feels like we're trending in a much higher trajectory than they are currently. But I wonder if we had played this in Mexico, and I wonder if we play this outside of American soil, if that would help us sharpen our teeth as well for some of these competitions that are coming up. But then I think, guess what? Copa America's at home. World Cup's at home in 26. Why do we need to go leave American soil and when all the games are going to be here anyway? Jesse, thoughts on this?
Have we outgrown Mexico? I wouldn't put it like that, but certainly we're better than them right now. You know, that part I think is evident. It's a little hard, you know, obviously we talked about this after the Jamaica game. They were going to play better against Mexico because the game was going to be different. It was going to actually access some of the better qualities of what our team is, right, than maybe what the Jamaican game did. And so, you know, it would almost be, okay, how do you want to look at it? Do you want to look at the Jamaica performance or the Mexico performance? And then what would you say? Look, in general, again, I think it was another step forward, a good moment for the U.S., important that they feel some positive energy to go into the summer. But the summer is really going to be the true test for me, you know? And when you're having to play different opponents, better opponents. You know, again, I've referenced this a few times, but I can imagine that the coaching staff is tired of playing the same teams, that the players are tired of playing the same teams. Like, it's time for some bigger challenges and some new challenges. And I think that's what we'll talk about the 23s later and how great of an experience this window was for them. But this is what we need. We need bigger challenges to help these guys get better and grow and understand what the best games are about.
Well, starting on June 8th, we have 5 games on our schedule. We'll take on Colombia in a friendly first. On the 12th, we'll take on Brazil. Then Copa America starts. We got Bolivia on the 23rd, Panama on the 27th, and Uruguay on July 1st. Those 5 games are going to determine quite a bit about this team and our coaching staff as well. All right, we're going to have our first break of call, what you want. When we come back, a special guest, Felipe Cardenas, is going to be joining us to talk all things Mexico. Don't go anywhere.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to Call It What You Want. I'm Jimmy Conrad alongside Jesse Marsh and Charlie Davies. And we have a very special guest joining us here, Felipe Cardenas. And Felipe, we're having you on the show, not only because you're super handsome, that's first and foremost, but secondly, because you're going to give us some insight about El Tri, Mexico. What is their deal? This might be one of the more poor sides of Mexico that I've seen in quite some time. What do they do now to fight their way out of it? Because obviously there's a lot of conversation going around the team and what's next for them, because they're not looking great heading into the Copa America.
First of all, thanks for the invite. I'm really excited to be on the show. This is this show. There's a lot of buzz around this podcast lately. I'm happy to jump on and throw some gasoline on the fire here. Let me give you some context first. Like, why would I know about Mexico? Right, I'm a Colombian American. Like, I don't follow that national team other than what I have to do for work. But in 2019, when Tata Martino took the job, you know, I had covered him for 2 years in Atlanta. I covered the MLS Cup championship that he won. And when he got the job, it was just like a natural progression. Let's see how he goes from MLS stardom to one of the most difficult jobs in world football. And I think at the time, remember, you know, Tata Martino, and speaking to people close to him over the last few years, like, he wanted the U.S. job. Okay, like he was into that opportunity. He really wanted it. Him and his staff were really shooting for that job after the 2018 World Cup fiasco for the United States. It doesn't work out, and then he goes to Mexico. And I remember thinking, this might work out for him. You know, he has some talent there. You know, Chicharito Hernandez was still the guy. He was still scoring goals. You know, he still had a lot left in the tank. And when you looked at the talent level, you thought, you know, this is still Mexico. And you go back to 2019, they win the Gold Cup. They beat the U.S. in that final in Chicago. I was there, and I remember it was really one of the last times where I saw a Mexico and a U.S. game really, really be tactical. Like, you could see it on the pitch, Greg and Tata moving players around, finding matchups, you know, really finding weaknesses mid game. And it really felt like this was the right move for him. The pandemic starts and everything really went downhill for Mexico from there. To answer your question, you know, I think it's really difficult to just say, hey, they don't have talent, or they need to invest in the academy system. I think that's what is really worrying people in Mexico. And having covered them for 3 years, having gone to Mexico City, seen their training facilities, spoken to executives, heard all their pitches about what they're going to do leading up to 2026, It really sounds like their biggest issue just is the development of the modern day footballer. And that was something that when they started to lose these games against the US, again, speaking to people close to Tata over the years, he knew it. He knew that athleticism, speed, the modern game where everyone has to be versatile, everyone has to be a two-way player. The US had that squad and Mexico didn't. And I think that's what you saw. So right now in Mexico, the sky is falling again and everyone is saying we need to invest more in our players. But at the same time, suddenly they want to hire Jose Mourinho. So they don't know what they want to do right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this was the first time I've been in the stadium for this match in a long time. And for me, you could see the talent disparity. And, you know, I remember when Eric Winalda made the comment way back when that he hated Mexicans or Mexican national team. And I felt differently. I always kind of looked up to the way that Mexico played. And I love Mexican football. And it was a big reason why I went to Chivas USA. And it was about the way they played, but it was also the talent they had. You know, when you go back over time and you think of Chicharito, Gio Dos Santos, you know, Blanco, you think of Claudio Suarez, Ramon Ramirez, Carlos Vela, you can say more recently. Like, I just remember that there were big talents in the team. And you touched a little bit that, okay, there. I do believe that there's some aspect where the U.S. has gotten better and the athleticism has become an issue. But why are they not producing any more star players? Like, what's happening? I remember going down to those academies and playing against their young teams, whether it was with Guadalajara and Chivas or Club America, and all these U20 teams you used to play when I was younger were so talented and so many good players, and I felt like they were running circles around us. Where has that gone? Why is it dried up? Or is it just that the disparity, the U.S. is getting better and better and Mexico's kind of staying the same?
I think when you look at the players that you just mentioned, Blanco, Luis Hernandez, Garcia Aspe, like these guys that you remember at these World Cups that would just show up and play like they would run through fire for their national team. That's the Mexico that I remember watching. And that was the Mexico that when they would play the U.S., you felt they're the favorites. Like, these guys have it. They've got the culture, the passion, and everything. I think right now, though, when you think about the players that they are starting to develop or need to develop more, you know, I'm certainly not one to say, you know, the taller you are, the better you're going to be in elite football. No, it doesn't always matter. It doesn't always mean that you have to be a big player, but they have not always produced, for instance, center backs that can go to Europe, fullbacks that go to Europe, that can transition to that game, that can play ball to feet, and really be technical in a place where they go to Europe and they're going to excel. If you look at the modern day Mexican player, I think what's where they're struggling is that they're still stuck in one very unique style of play, which isn't really akin to what the world is really moving towards. And so I remember Tata Martino and his staff and over the years when he would get pounded by the press about not calling in certain players or not giving Santi Jimenez enough time or relying on the veteran players. That was when the dominoes starting to fall, because you could see a staff that said, these are our players. We can only rely on certain players. And listen, Tata would try. I think he, over the 4 years, I remember, there were hundreds of players that he tried out, like over 30 under 20 players he gave shots to, and they just didn't make the cut. The concern in Mexico is that, well, if you watch a Liga MX game, you're going to see technique, you're going to see creativity, but you're not going to see stars. And that is a big Pandora's box that is starting to open, because the pay for foreign stars in Mexico is really good. And remember, the Liga MX has gone from requiring teams to play U20 players in the first division at least a couple of minutes, and U23 players have to get time, and limiting foreigners on a 18 man sheet, and only a certain number can play on match day. So they've tried to put the Mexican footballer in a better place, and it's just taken more time than they thought. And again, when I mention I've gone to Mexico, when I go to Mexico City and I sit with these executives and I come back, I always say the same thing, man, that is a proper football country. Like, you feel it when you're there. But right now, they're in a place where they've never been. I think that's the U.S. has been here before. They've faced failure. They've been second best. And perhaps that's the experience that Mexico is just getting used to. That's probably something that they've struggled with overall.
Felipe, to me, it just sounds like it's a bunch of excuses at this point, because I look at a player like Diego Lainez. I mean, the first iteration of the CONCACAF Nations League, he was striking fear into every single U.S. player, just gifted on the ball. And that's a product of Mexico. You go back to Carlos Vela and so on, Chicharito. There are a number of players who were produced in Mexico during my era. And I feel like nothing has changed in terms of the opportunities in Mexico. Maybe they need more resources guided to development. But if you look at the U.S. and failing to qualify in 2018, everyone said, oh, we're not producing players, when actually we are producing players. It's probably the mismanagement of players at the time, the poor coaching, is what ended up doing the U.S. in. So if you're looking at Mexico right now, what direction are they going to go in terms of leadership? I feel like leadership and coaching the first team, because Jimmy Lozano, I feel like, has done the best he can do so far. Is that someone that they're going to say, oh, we'll ride it out until we can get someone like a Jose Mourinho? And if Mourinho came, he's not developing young Mexican players. No. He's trying to win now.
Yeah, Jaime Lozano, I also had a chance to sit with him in Dallas a couple weeks before Nations League, and he was very impressive to me. And I understood why he got the job, and he explained it to me. He said, you know, this, if I am here until 2026, it ends up being a 6-year cycle for me, because he had a lot of these players, the U20 players at the 2020 Olympics that won bronze, and so these are the same players that are coming up. But yeah, remember, I agree with you. I think sometimes they are excuses, and sometimes they're just realities and slaps in the face. Like, you know, I as a Colombian American, I follow very closely South American football. Like, South American qualifiers are brutal, and everyone, like the nationalism that takes place in South America with football is very severe. And anytime Mexico gets brought up in Comebol or South America, there's always like, they're Mexico. Like, what business do they have being talking like they're a top side? They haven't won anything, and that's difficult for, I think, Mexico to accept in their own bubble. But right now, rather than giving excuses, I think you have to see what has happened since the 2022 World Cup. It was the second time that they essentially cleaned house at the federation level. They did it before the World Cup in 2021. Everyone was let go except for the president, and then Tata's staff remained in house. They go to the World Cup, they crash out in the group stage. I was in Qatar for that, where they had this big last sort of farewell press conference after that, the win against Saudi Arabia that wasn't enough. And it was like being at a funeral. And there were reporters taking shots at the executives that were up on the podium saying, it's your fault. This is on you. You can talk about talent. You can talk about bad luck and the goals that we needed, but this is on the executives and the federation. Then they cut more heads off at the federation. They bring in a new president who then hires another consultant to choose the next coach. And he chose Diego Coca, another Argentine, another foreign manager, when the entire country was screaming for a Mexican manager after Tata Martino. Diego Coca lasts, I think, 7 games. And that's when they land in Jaime Lozano. So the same problems that they've had, the way it's so volatile at the top of the federation, that politically, it matters in Latin American football. It really does. And it really influences decisions. I don't think it's a resource problem. Trust me, like Mexico, there is so much money that is being produced and pumped in to Mexican football at the senior men's level, now the women's level, and at the youth level. So it's not about resources. It's just about, I think they've rested on their laurels for far too long. And what is finally being said in Mexico from the toughest pundits is they've finally accepted, not only are the Americans better than us, they've passed us along. And now they're looking at MLS as like, hey, they at least know what they're doing. We've gotten rid of ProRel. We don't have a salary cap. We're spending like crazy. You know, at least they've stuck to what they know in MLS, and they can attract stars, and they don't need the league to, they don't need the league to supply the national team, which was something that happened for decades in Mexico. So it's a tough button to press to reset and think that the solutions are going to be there. The thing is, they don't have time to start replanning. They just have to go with what they have.
Yeah, Felipe, I want to use Julio Davino's, who's the Mexico sporting director. He put out a statement saying losing the Nations League final is a hard blow for everyone. After 5 years of not being able to defeat the United States, the first thing is to humbly recognize our reality in order to rebuild ourselves. The answer is work, structure, and union. Trust in all parties, from our coach to this management of managers who are working to restructure our football from grassroots and with the support of all the clubs. In this, we are all going together. But you brought up an interesting word, time. I don't think they have enough time to flip this on its head and get something positive or potentially scrape out of the group in the Copa America, but maybe not get to the heights that they expect or want. And I love in his statement about reality, we have to look at this realistically. Now, I actually want to focus on the World Cup, because since they're one of the hosts, that's a very big deal for, like it is here and for Canada as well, to really accelerate the growth of the game. I know Mexico is a lot more mature than it is in the United States in terms of the infrastructure underneath it, but it's still a big opportunity for them to maximize the visibility they're going to get from a tournament of that magnitude.
Yeah, and they've been here before. They've hosted World Cups before. Their teams have always done well. Obviously, yes, they haven't gotten to the fifth game, El Quinto Partido, but this is not going to be new for them. They should not have deer in headlights when they're at the Azteca for the inaugural game of the 2026 World Cup. And I think I do push back. I agree with Jesse. Like, when you watch the game the other night, the final, other than the talent disparity, which I didn't think it was all over the field, but it was in very significant parts of the field. The other thing was just the psychological aspect that we don't really talk about. Like, you could see an American team, I thought from the first minute, that just looked really confident and really felt like this was their game. This was their, even their stadium. They didn't care about the noise and the Mexican fans. They were just there to win. And Mexico looked like if they lose, it's another crisis. So that's one thing. The psychological part is hard to just fix. And I know that was a concern after 2022. Now, for the 2026 World Cup, you know, I don't think Mexico is in a place where they just don't produce good players anymore. They do. You know, we may not see them though. I think they have a cultural issue where it's not really in their nature to play young players to give them valuable minutes. That was something that we saw U.S. soccer really double down on. We're going to go with this young team. We're going to be the youngest team in the world, and we're going to take our lumps and we're going to go. And I think that's really hard for other teams to do. And Mexico, especially when that's not the norm in Liga MX. It's very veteran driven. The national team has always been like that. And they're going to have to, even though I agree with you, Jimmy, that there's not a lot of time to do this. They're going to have to start putting players in positions where they learn on the fly. And that's the only way that they're going to really cut the gap. But I still like Mexico's chances when this World Cup comes. It's, again, we don't know who's going to be their coach. We don't know who's going to be their star. But I think tradition and history is in their favor when they are hosting and when they have that pressure to be a home team. I think we know how FIFA works when the draws come out for host nations. I think they're going to be set up. And it's a 48-team field, which should ease the opening rounds for these host nations. But they're certainly in crisis mode again.
Great insight, Felipe. Just last question, and let's see if we can do it quick. I'll give you three categories, and you rank which you think is most relevant to the least relevant in terms of where the gap, why the gap is there. First is youth development coaching. Second is type of athleticism that they have in their players. And third is first team / professional coaching. What are, rank those three issues?
Okay, I would put the youth development number one. What was the third one? Because I thought that would be a good two.
The professional coaching or the coaching in the first team.
Okay, so then I would put that at two. And then your second one?
Type of athlete.
Okay, so type of athlete. So that's youth development, coaching acumen, and that whole new world, and then athleticism. I think youth development is again, I'm not saying anything new, because that's where all the pundits in Mexico are really leaning on. That's their biggest issue. You're not seeing young players coming up on a routine basis. Every club, though, has decades and decades of academy history. So it's not like MLS, where the academy system is new. that's why I think number two is coaching. And when I talk to, for instance, Jaime Lozano, and Guillermo Almada, who's coaching now at Pachuca, and he was in the running to be the next men's national team coach. These are coaches who have told me and have told other reporters that the young player in Mexico, and this is, again, this isn't going to be anything new to you guys. They have so many more distractions now. Like, some of them don't want to be
elite. They won the gold medal in 2012, and they got the bronze in the last Olympics.
And what happened to those players? What happened to those players? Right. They're not even in the picture anymore. They're not in the picture anymore. Some of them flamed out. Yeah, a lot of them flamed out. A lot of them had too much hype. They couldn't handle it, or they weren't good enough when they got to the first division. And so that's what some of these coaches see as the biggest problem. Not only are we not developing enough players, but they're not staying in the system. They're not staying in football. They're not becoming not even elite players, but just starting 11 players week in and week out. The coaching also, you know, Jaime Lozano, when I spoke with him, this is a very modern thinking coach. You know, he told me, I take coaching courses, I take communication coaches, I take public speaking coaches, I go to Europe, I talk to coaches. Like, he is trying to get as much input from other people as possible. And in Mexico, you know, there's still this, I think, very traditional way of approaching football, approaching training sessions. Where's the analytics going? I think it's still new school for an old school football. And then finally, athleticism is one that, again, I brought it up earlier. I think that's what we can see and we can touch, right? Like, we see that at the highest levels for the senior men's national team. You know, the other day, Argentina, their U23s lost to Mexico's U23s 3-0. So that was a big headline in Mexico that, well, okay, we just lost to the U.S., but our U23s beat one of the better Olympic teams currently. So there's talent, but do they care enough? You know, are they too coddled in Mexico? Is it too comfortable for them? You know, is it too comfortable for them? Do they need to leave earlier? That's the other thing that is really starting to come to the surface. But right now, man, it's like, you can't just push the magic button. You just can't do that.
Well, Felipe, we appreciate your time. Love your knowledge and insights on the Mexican national team. We're going to have you back on the show because this is a bigger conversation very, very soon. Thank you so much.
Anytime, guys. It was my pleasure. Take care.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. It's Michael Richards here. You might have seen me on CBS working on their Champions League coverage over the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you about an exciting new podcast that I've been working on. It's called The Rest Is Football. It's me, alongside Gary Lineker and Alan Shearer, two absolute legends of the game. The show combines topical debate from the world of soccer along with outrageous tales from our careers. And I mean, outrageous. Just search The Rest Is Football wherever you get your podcasts. All the best from Big Meats.
The eighth match now under Thierry Henry since he was announced as the under-21's head coach. He's got a 5-win, 2-loss record. 4 months from now, they'll be facing off against the United States to open up the Olympics. As the United States, an opportunity to test themselves against a side of some serious caliber.
That may have hit a hand. The referee may have indeed given a penalty here. Calamuendo buries it in the bottom right corner. Rolled off. Brilliance for two. Left footer from distance, and the French take a 2-0 lead. Yao, overlapping run. Puts onto his right, finds the back of the net. The U.S. have won. Kate Cowell has one with him. He'll do it himself. And the U.S. equalize, coming back down two in front of a stunned crowd here.
A fantastic result for our U23s against France in a friendly, and I emphasize a friendly because we're actually playing them officially first in the Olympics in Paris this summer. So that It's a nice little teaser, a little appetizer for that entree to be here in, what, 3 or 4 months? Pretty exciting. But a good performance overall from our guys. France, obviously, pretty stacked in multiple positions. At 79th minute, they're up 2-0. They probably think they're going to lock it up. We score basically two identical goals from the left side cutting in on our right to get the 2-2 results. Two goals in 3 minutes from Cade Cowell and Griffin Yao, as you saw. Jesse, you watched this game. What were your favorite moments from this? Because I liked that we had a little bit of not giving up, that spirit that I feel like our team is known for maybe more than some others out there.
Yeah, so I only saw the highlights of the Guinea match, but it looked like a good performance. And, you know, in this one, I thought we had a really good start. France makes a couple of changes from the team that played the Ivory Coast, but we had a good start. Paxton Aronson had a big chance in the beginning phases of the match. And then France's kind of quality took over the game a little bit. And I think getting to the 2-0 lead was earned. But I thought that the three in the middle were pretty solid in Tessman, Busio, and Morris. And I thought Paxton Aronson for the whole match was pretty active. Paredes was pretty active as well. Duncan Maguire wasn't able to get himself going after the initial phases, but he defended a lot and did a lot of dirty work for the team. And you know, even in the phase where France had the ball a lot and was better, it wasn't like they created a ton of great chances. So I thought overall, the performance was solid and they were tested, but they tried to play out of the back. They tried to do the things that Marco Mitrovic said before the game, that they were going to stay true to what they believed was important for them to be a good team. And then obviously that when they went to the subs and they brought in Griffin Yao and they brought in Cade Cowell and the plays that they made, you know, again, you start to see a pretty deep U23 team with some good talent, not the same level of talent as France, but on the day, what a great experience. You know, the stadium looked pretty full. The energy in the stadium was big. The opponent and the way they played and the way they tested our team was I think real and put them in a tough game. And then in the end, they come out with a 2-2 draw. So in this window, I would think that Marko Mitrovic has to feel great about the things that they accomplished, the challenges that they experienced, and the way they responded, and the things that they will learn from it. So I look at it as what a fantastic window, what a great opportunity for this team to test themselves, and that they should feel like they belong, and they have a lot to learn, and they have a lot to get better at, but that they belong. So we won't be able to catch France by surprise in the Olympics, but nonetheless, we will be much stronger for these 2 weeks that they had together.
Okay, now Charlie, L'Equipe, who is a French publication, had their rankings and ratings for this particular match. And Tanner Tessman and Patrick Schulte in goal were the only two players to have sevens. There were a lot of fives and sixes within our team. John Tolkien got a three, and I think a little unfair, a little harsh, because he gave up the penalty in that particular regard. But outside of Tessman and Schulte, was there anybody else who you thought, hot damn, this guy is the goods? And not only will he be good for us in the Olympics and maybe a player that we build around, but also a team for the senior national team.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. But in terms of players that I think improved and showed something, I was really impressed with Brian Reynolds, because that's a player who I hadn't really seen in a while. And to see him bursting up and down the right side, he looked good with his pace and dribbling. And they had some good opportunities, like Jesse said, to start. There was a couple chances where, you know, on another day, maybe Paxton Aronson scores on that header. I think Kevin Paredes had a couple of half chances. They were dangerous on the long ball when Duncan Maguire would check in and draw one or two center backs. So I think, you know, there are opportunities for the U.S. to really score a couple of goals and take France by surprise. But ultimately, this game was a lot closer than I think anyone ever anticipated, because the U.S. did have some good chances and didn't concede too much. I thought Tanner Tessman definitely took a step forward with his progress. I thought he did a good job of clogging up the middle, and his distribution has improved quite a bit. So I think Maximilian Dietz as a center back also looked really good. So that was a position that I think we all were questioning, the center backs of this youth national team. And he looked pretty solid. So I think, if anything, this really helped the U.S. in terms of confidence moving forward. Now, the French team is going to look quite different. They had three injured players. They had three players go down from illness before this game. So Bradley Barcola picked up a hamstring strain. So this is not the full strength French side. And throw on top of the three overage players that they'll get. So if anything, it allowed the U.S. to say, hey, they're not that much better. On our day, we can compete with these guys. And it's the first game of the Olympics in the group stage. Go out and try and get that shock draw, just like you did here. No one, the expectations are going to be that you lose against a strong French side. So I'm very impressed with what they're able to do, accomplish on this trip.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out and who Marko Mihajlović decides are his overage players that he wants to bring into the team and which positions those go. And you mentioned this about competition for places, Chuck, on the French side, but also the U.S. are going to have some competition for places as well. And in one area, though, Griffin Yao, who was the man of the match against Guinea, had two assists in that one, scored in this one off of the bench. He had a chance to sit down with Morning Footy and answer one of your questions, Chuck. Let's hear what he had to say.
You obviously showed your quality in this last camp. There's only 18 spots on the Olympic team. How competitive is it for these 18 spots, knowing that there's three overage players that can come into the picture?
Yeah, I think it's super competitive. And I think that's kind of what makes, the whole dynamic of the group so great. You know, everyone is trying to show their best at 24/7, you know, whether it's at training, whether it's in the games, whether, you know, you're coming off the bench, whether you're starting, everyone is, you know, a top player. So everyone is constantly competing, constantly trying to give their best. And yeah, it's definitely high stakes. But you know, like I said, I think that's a great environment for a team. You know, I don't think you ever want to be a player and have the feeling like, you know, I'm comfortable. You know, for me personally, when I'm uncomfortable and when I'm feeling like, okay, you know, I've got something to prove, I've got something to show, you know, that's where I think me personally, I've had my best games is when I'm out there to prove something to everyone.
All right. Griffin. Yeah. I love that little chip on his shoulder.
I got to say, Jimmy,
go ahead.
I got to say, this is what even the European scouts and clubs love about the Americans is their fearlessness, their desire to compete, their desire to get better. Like, it's amazing. Whether you look at the first team or the Olympic team, like, the American spirit and the belief that these kids have in themselves and the desire to go get tested in difficult situations in Europe and be put over their head and that they know this is the best way to improve. Like, you just have to, you know, really tip your hat to all these young men and the way that they're trying to be the best version of themselves and what they're becoming because of it. It's amazing. I love that interview. Loved it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Griffin Yao, he had a comment recently where he said that his current club in Belgium, and I guess you take it with a grain of salt because he's currently playing for this team, Vesterlo, who's got 6 goals and 2 assists in 20 matches this season in the Belgian first division, said they believed in him, or he felt like they believed in him a little bit more than where he came from in DC United. So I don't know. You take it with a grain of salt, of course, but I do appreciate that mindset and the mentality, and long may that continue. This is going to be a hell of a summer for both our full team and for our Olympic team, and I can't wait for it to kick off. All right, we're going to take our next break of Call It What You Want. When we come back, we're going to talk about MLS refereeing, everybody's favorite topic, so you're not going to want to miss it. Hello and welcome back to Call It What You Want. I'm Jimmy alongside Jesse Marshmallow Marsh and Charlie Chuck Wagon Davies, and we are talking a little MLS ref situation. The lockout is over. The new agreement is finalized between Pro and the MLS ref or the referee association and now MLS. Everything's all worked out, and the agreement's going to run through the end of the 2030 season. So a 7-year deal contains sizable raises for refs and assistant refs and for video assistant referees as well. It'll shout out to VAR, all the VAR action out there. A lot of pressure those VAR referees are under. Ultimately, though, and Chuck, I'll come to you first on this, a rising tide lifts all boats. So the quality of play, in theory, should get better because the refereeing is going to be better. And the referee was starting to be the main story in MLS early part of the season because there were a lot of blown calls, especially this past weekend. And I'm kind of glad this is resolved. What about you?
Yeah, I'm thrilled because we don't want referees ruining the game, right? Making the wrong calls and having the results go the wrong way. Just, you know, I think you saw Drew Fisher reffing in the Nations League and you're like, oh, I remember when it was much more straightforward and calls that you could kind of predict. So I'm excited that they were able to get this group this deal done because I know how hard these referees work and I feel like they've really improved over the years. So now the quality of the games can stay at a super high level.
Now, Jesse, do you feel like this lockout and the lack of top referees for about a month will now give fans and coaches and players more appreciation for the quality that they were missing out on? Like, do you think there's going to be greater ref appreciation or do you think we're just going to fall back into referees are terrible?
Well, it seemed that we avoided any real major controversies, right? Which when you bring in replacement referees, I think that would be the major issue. In general, like, you know, especially I think it was really great getting to know Christina Uncle more and hearing more of her perspective of how much, you know, they put into things. And I've always known this, right? And it's always hard because the refereeing is the worst job in the world. No question. But, you know, let's get the referees back. They're a big part of the development of the sport and of the league. Let's get this thing moving in all ways in the right direction and making everybody feel like they're a part of it. And let's find a way to have the best games, the best competitions. You know, it was interesting hearing Felipe talk about how MLS, even Mexico, is now looking at how great MLS has been developed. I think we're all proud of that. I certainly am. I'm still a big MLS fan and really happy to see the product get better and better. So let's all be fully aware and respectful to say that the referees are still a big part of that.
Oh, there's no question for me that the referees, they really control the flow and rhythm of the game. I mean, if you got a ref that's calling everything tight, it's just going to stifle any type of flow or fluidity to a game. And if you have a ref that's letting things go, that can get a little bit dangerous as well, because maybe there's some tackles flying around. That's the game I prefer. Those are the refs that I love and adore. But, you know, sometimes it does get a little bit out of control. Then the emotions take over. And now it's a lot harder, I think, to wrangle that back in once that's been released, that type of emotion. And so finding those refs that really know how to find that balance, I think, are the special ones. And not only is this important for just the quality of the league right now, but I also think with the money that's being thrown at these refs and they're getting a livable wage and something they can aspire to. I mean, for the ones that are coming through the system, that this starts to lay the foundation and the groundwork for a job that they can be proud of and a job where they can earn a real income and try to get better at their craft. Because the better the referees are, the better the quality is going to be on the field. And yeah, like I said before, rising tide lifts all boats. So I'm excited this is done. I hope that it's going to continue to permeate through the system and not just at the top level, but everywhere else underneath. Because having good referees goes a long, long way. All right, we're going to take our last break and call it what you want. When we come back, we got our little stretch run. We're going to pay our respects to Midge Purse, the U.S. Women's National Team player who tore her ACL. We'll talk a little bit about her and her long road to recovery right when we come back after this. Welcome back to the stretch run of Call It What You Want. I'm Jimmy alongside Jesse and Chuck. And as I teased before the break, let's talk a little Midge Purse. It just got announced earlier today. She came out and said that she tore her ACL and she's obviously gutted. I'm paraphrasing here. Because she was, Chuck, I'll come to you first as our resident attacker here. She was on the precipice of really breaking through and becoming a regular for the U.S. Women's National Team. And the Olympics were there. She could probably taste it. She was going to be a part of the Olympic team. And now that's taken away. She was excellent for Gotham, especially in the final last year. I don't even know what you say to her at this point, because it's so disheartening, the situation that she finds herself in.
Well, you know, your dream always as a footballer is to become a World Cup champion, right? Play in a World Cup and eventually win one. And she got dropped from the World Cup, right? She didn't make the squad. And she came back and was the NWSL final MVP, right? So that just goes to show you go from rock bottom to the mountaintop. And now here's an occasion where she goes back down again. And it's the waves of being professional, right? Things are go really well at some points, and you can have these moments where it's injury or things you can't control. And so I don't doubt that she'll bounce back. I mean, look at Caterina Macario again, another player who's had to miss a World Cup and deal with all these injuries, and now she's scoring goals in Champions League. So she's brilliant. She's smart. She was really coming on as a professional. So I don't doubt that she'll make it back on the pitch and continue to do what she was doing. So yeah, my heart is broken for her, but I know she'll bounce back and do whatever it takes to get back on the pitch and have success.
Now, Jesse, when you dealt with players that had these type of season-ending injuries, you know, what would be the best way, you think, or how would you approach it? And it's so hard. I'm heartbroken for her.
It's never. I mean, you know, the women's game, if you ever go to a professional women's training or the national team's training, they're always doing ACL protocol, right? Because this issue within specifically our sport with women is a massive issue, and how they can prevent as many of these injuries as happening as possible, it's so difficult. And so many of these girls wind up, and these women wind up having these injuries. So for us, it's like often the hamstring injuries that we get. I mean, there's ACLs in the men's game as well, but it's always managing so that the power of the men doesn't lead to the hamstring injuries. So, you know, it reminds me of Chris Armas missing out 2 World Cups and an Olympics. And I saw what he went through and how painful that was to miss those big events. And you just always want to be there for them. And you know how painful it is to miss big events, playing for your country in big tournaments. So, you know, we wish her the best for sure. And a speedy recovery. And obviously we all feel terrible that she's not getting a chance to live out one of her dreams.
Yeah, I think the note that I would send to everybody is that she's going to get a lot of love and attention right now when everything just gets announced, but you got to check in on her in about a month or two when she's probably going through some tough days and things aren't going as fast as she'd like. So that's a note for all of us and for everybody at home. Let's keep checking in on Midge and anybody else that might be hurt. And yeah, that's my big takeaway for today. All right, that's it. We're calling it a show. Call What You Want is done for today. We appreciate all of your love and adoration for what we've done. We were thrilled to meet all of you that saw us in person in Dallas, and hopefully they'll send us on location again very, very soon. Just throwing it out there. There's a couple friendlies in Copa America. Just throwing that out there. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Take us. See you soon. Later.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.